from the Sky News Centre at 6. Theresa May standing by Boris Johnson after he said Donald Trump would do a better job of Brexit negotiations than her. The Foreign Secretary was recorded at a Tory event saying the PM needs to show guts in the talks. She's brushed off his comments.
He has strong views on Brexit, but so do I. And that's why I'm getting on with the job of delivering what the British people want, which is Brexit, for us to leave the European Union, take back control of our money, our laws and our borders.
A man's been charged with the manslaughter and robbery of a 100-year-old woman. Sophia Zatchin died on Wednesday after her neck was broken when she was attacked last week. The Royal College of Nursing says a pay rise for NHS workers in England over the next 3 years could go further. It says it will look at how the salary of those living in high-cost areas could be boosted after that period. The Sainsbury's boss, caught singing We're in the Money in a TV studio, is getting a pay rise of more than £1 million. Mike Coop has earned £3.4 million in the past year. In sport, the Premier League will have a winter break for the first time from the 2019-2020 season. It'll be staggered over 2 weeks, meaning there won't be any weekends without top-flight matches. The Premier League's outgoing executive chairman, Richard Scudamore, says they've worked closely with the Football Association on the plan.
The FA said the winter break, mid-season player break, is so important to us that we will be prepared to move the FA Cup fifth round to midweek. We said, OK, what we'll do with that rather than... Yeah, we'll split a programme. I thought it was quite a creative solution.
And Rafael Nadal remains on course for an 11th French Open tennis title after easing into the final in Paris. The defending champion beat Argentina's Juan Martin Del Potro in straight sets 6-4, 6-1, 6-2. That's the latest. I'm Kieran Kaur.
BCFM. Feel good and relaxed with Bilingual That Polish Show on BCFM Radio.
It's Friday, it's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the 7 o'clock news, we go live to Turin, northwest Italy, where the New World Order, well, that's the bankers that buy our political parties and the maniacs that start all these illegal wars. They're trying to grab resources and deny them to everyone else. Priests of globalisation and the creators of the European Union. That's the Bilderberg Conference in Turin. Who are the British participants? Who is this Democratic Party state governor who looks tipped to take over as US president from Trump in 2020? Why haven't we heard about any of this on the mainstream news? Who is the spider in the middle of the web? Henry Kissinger's choice to take over as next Chancellor of Germany. And who's the former West German Chancellor from the 1960s who attended these Bilderberg conference? He was a former Nazi propaganda radio chief and a Bilderberger, and another former Bilderberg participant who worked at Deutsche Bank, stealing the wealth of Jews, another so-called Untermensch, another Bilderberger. To the current meeting, and why so many Google and Google spin-off participants? What is quantum computing, and what's its military and surveillance uses? It's rumoured to be close to replicating human consciousness, digital humans. We hope to speak to journalists Hannah Borno and Charlie Skelton live from Turin. So, Martin, I think we should start really by explaining in short terms. I mean, that was a slightly, one-sided point of view. But, I mean, the Bilderberg conferences, why is it that we get so little coverage? We've had a few sort of jokey articles, one in the Mail on Sunday, for example, the Daily Mail, just sort of making light of it, saying, oh, well, this is just a bunch of businessmen meeting up.
Well, as you know, at one stage, they denied that they existed at all. And they were quite a secretive organisation set up after the war to integrate Western Europe and the US and formulate strategy for the elite. It's obviously not the only place that the elite meets, but it's quite an important forum. And, of course, for many years they tried to deny that they existed. Then they said they did exist. But, of course, lots of the top media bosses are in the inside of the conference having, you know, private discussions, and they don't want anybody else to know what they're talking about.
In fact, some of the main media owners from right across Europe and the United States are in there, plus the Bloomberg and The Economist.
Well, indeed. So Bloomberg and The Economist don't report on Bilderberg because they're invited in.
Well, they do sometimes, and they make light of it. They say, well, this is just a bunch of anybody, you know, business people. People have got a right to get together.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I think the real problem for the rest of us is the politicians that go. George Osborne went a few years ago and he took his Treasury team with him. And they say at the same
time... Well, he's there now.
Well, exactly, but at the same time, he's a private individual now, if you like.
Well, he's the editor of
the Evening Standard. But the point is, you know, the guy who runs the Evening Standard can say that he can go. The real problem is the politicians who go, because they ought to report back what's discussed.
But not if politics, not if political parties are owned by bankers.
Well, no, I'm just talking about what the rules ought to be, and I'll recognise.
But I mean, surely those rules went out the window years ago.
Well, no, we all know that in actual fact, those rules don't mean anything, but they are supposed to mean something. So the taxpayers, for example, paid for Treasury officials to go with Osborne when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer to Bilderberg. We are entitled to know what was discussed because we're paying for him to be there. Now, private businesses can organise anything they like and they don't have to discuss it with anybody. But politicians are supposedly answerable for what they do to the electorate, especially if we're paying for the junket.
What about the media, though? Because, I mean, surely they are even worse in a way because they've become this kind of spearhead of the war machine now. We've had, the, you know, obviously the Iraq WMD lies, the dodgy dossier and that sort of thing. But actually, the media seems to be, and very recently it was involved in what was effectively a complete scam against the entire Western world's public, saying that there'd been a chemical weapons attack just outside Damascus.
Well, indeed. Well, it was in Douma. But anyway, the thing is that the BBC, for example, have got some kind of public interest charter. They certainly shouldn't be in there.
It's a royal charter.
Yeah, well, I understand that they have been in the past inside rather on the outside. Now, that's wrong. That's wrong. If they should report, if they're going to go, they should report what's said. And if they can't report what's said, they shouldn't go. And of course, private businesses can do what they like, but public institutions have got other responsibilities.
The individual who was on the executive board of the BBC, you're probably talking about here, is Marcus Agius. He's now on the steering committee of Bilderberg. But he, at the time, was on the executive board of the BBC. His wife is Catherine de Rothschild.
Well, there you are. I mean, what we're really looking at here is a bit of schmoozing and networking by the elite movers and shakers. Now, we can't really... I mean, the argument they made... When they went to Watford, for example, they argued that it was a private meeting and therefore they didn't have to report anything that went on in it. At the same time, the taxpayers of the area picked up half the bill for the policing. If it was really a private event, they should have paid for all the policing. But they didn't. The British taxpayer paid for it. Now, if the British taxpayer is going to play to police it, then we ought to know what's going on.
There's been a lot of
the
news today about the G7 meeting. It used to be the G8 until Russia was kicked out over the inverted commas annexation of Crimea. But Donald Trump has caused a bit of a storm today by saying Russia should be let back into the G7. Let's make it the G8 again.
Well, I mean, that's typical of Trump's rather mercurial personality is all I can say. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
You can say much more than that, Martin. What about the reasons for it? What is it that, I mean, because obviously the Western elites don't want to have, you know, be negotiating with Russia.
Well, I think
the British, for example, they had this whole Skripal story back in February and March, which was designed to and actually succeeded in causing the expulsion of scores and scores of Russian diplomats. So why is Trump now sort of turning the tables and saying, actually, no, we want to be friends with Russia again?
Well, because Trump likes stirring the pot.
Is he just doing it for the hell of it?
Yeah, but just think about it. The Western powers have been forced by the Americans and the British in particular, and the Germans and the Austrians, for example, to put sanctions on Russia over Crimea. And then, on the back of the, you know, everybody gets ramped up and we're all told we've got to have sanctions on Russia. This is all terribly important. Bang, 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 bang. And then suddenly the Americans turn around and say, yeah, but we're going to have sanctions on you for having dealing with Iran. We're going to put sanctions on your steel and aluminium industries, but we want Russia back in. And you know what? What we want, we get. When we want Russia out, they're out. When we want Russia back, they're back.
But who is and in actual fact, because Trump doesn't always align with we, does it?
No, well, Trump represents a faction within the US ruling class. And, of course, there's other elements in the ruling class who are not happy with his strategy.
I mean, I don't know if that's true, Martin. I think sometimes Trump just does these things because he has a few of his own connections into France, personal connection, into Russia, and he just decides, right, well, they're trying to tell me to do this. I'm going to do something.
Well, what he's doing is he's turning one lot against... I mean, the Russians have still got sanctions on them. Trump isn't saying we're going to drop the sanctions. He's just saying that we can have them back in the G8. But if you're going to have them, you know, if you're going to have them back in the G8, then maybe you should drop the sanctions. And what he's doing at the same time, he's putting sanctions on Canada, he's putting sanctions on Mexico, he's putting sanctions on the EU, he's putting sanctions on China.
Well, this is maybe
the Chinese aren't going to be invited back into the G8, are they?
Well, this is
although the G8, maybe they should be in
this
it,
is, this
considering
is maybe,
how big they are.
Martin, this is maybe why, isn't he? It? Because he's actually got a whole load of people at the G7 now who he's having to face who are pretty annoyed with him for these... I mean, effectively, it's sanctions.
Well,
sanctions he's put onto Europe.
Well, Macron said if we have to become the G6, then that's what we'll have to do, because that's how bad it is. The European Union isn't in a strong position because everybody wants their piece of the American market, which is booming at the moment because they're running a massive budget deficit and still, basically not playing by the rules that everybody else is supposed to play by.
I mean, in a way,
but it's going to crash in the end, and then there's going to be a huge row.
Well, there is a relationship in a weird way between the Bilderberg conferences and the G7, and that is that the people that you see at Bilderberg, who you've never heard of before, quite often seem to pop up a few years later at the G7 running a country.
Well, I mean, what's interesting about this year's Bilderberg conference is it's running in tandem with the G7, whereas previously it used to be a couple of weeks before, didn't it? And then people would...
It was the week after, actually, so that there would be maybe decisions made at Bilderberg.
Indeed. And the suspicion was that discussions were had at Bilderberg and then the G7 just...
They were basically the
decisions.
The script was written
for the decisions
the
that had already been made.
The G8, or G7.
But I think they seem to be splitting into two bits.
I'm going to be really cruel now. Can you tell me which are the countries in the G7 at the moment?
In the G7, it's going to be Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Canada, Japan, and the US.
Yes, very good, very good. And they're actually meeting in Canada this year, so Trump hasn't got very far to go. But the other... meeting that's happening is this one over in Singapore. Now, what do you make of that, the potential rapprochement with North Korea and South Korea?
Well, there's a very interesting article by Dan Glazebrook this week, which I think was on RT.
Lives in Oxford, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think what he was saying that what may be happening here is what he calls the Rambouillet option. So they go to the meeting, they say to the North Koreans, right, you've got to completely denuclearise, surrender everything, and then we may decide to give you some help and support. And they're going to make them an offer that they can refuse, must refuse, a bit like Trump's ultimatum to Iran. And then, of course, they turn around and say, well, we went to a meeting with them and they just didn't agree to roll over and lie down. So now we've got to go to war with them. And I think you've got to be aware that that's the sort of thing that they do. That's exactly what they did to Serbia over Rambouillet. They invited everybody here to discuss it. There were supposed to be discussions about what should be done about Kosovo. The Serbians got various proposals. They got proposals. And they basically said that NATO had to be allowed to occupy Serbia. And at that point, the Serbs walked out. Same thing happened in 1914 with the Austrian note to the Serbs. It was designed to be unacceptable. So I suspect that the John Bolton faction within the US establishment, they're reconciled to this meeting now. They tried to sabotage it. They're reconciled to it, but they're going to make Trump's take such a hard line that the North Koreans will walk out or just will refuse to cooperate. And at that point, we're back to war. But of course, there is no realistic war option here. It's, you know, if you go to war with North Korea, the minimum they're thinking is 2 or 3 million dead. And of course, it could escalate from there.
Now,
so it's bonkers.
We said this last week too, but I'm going to ask you again because it seems to me like the basic question none of the mainstream press are asking. Trump is talking about denuclearization, but actually Kim Jong-un is not going to totally denuclearize, if there is such a real word as denuclearize. What he's going to be doing is he's going to be putting on the table, right, we are going to get rid of our test facilities and we're going to stop testing. We'll come in line with the non-proliferation treaty effectively.
Yep.
So you've got two sides of the table coming together, both with complete completely different expectations of what they're going
to
get
Pompeo,
out of this.
The head of the CIA, who's met to, you know, a senior North Korean official, he says that they, as far as he's concerned, that they are prepared to denuclearise. Now, I think that's a bit of spin, frankly. I can't see that it makes any sense for Kim Jong-un to offer to denuclearise. He's only talking to the Americans because he's got nuclear weapons. If he didn't have nuclear weapons, they wouldn't bother to talk to him. I think the possibility of a deal is definitely there. But don't forget, the overall game for the Americans is to mess the Chinese up. So they want this crisis to drag on so that the Chinese are constantly being distracted by it. And they can then use it as an excuse to put sanctions on China for supposedly, you know, supporting North Korea's more belligerent stance. And of course, the Chinese are being hooked in because they're now being, you know, Kim Jong-un and the Chinese have become quite thick and they quite like what he's trying to do, which is to negotiate.
The idea is
so they could be drawn into the
frame. This is all going to happen next Tuesday in Singapore. Do you think that they're... I mean, it almost seems like a face down. At some point, you know, surely these two concepts of what is denuclearisation are going to clash.
Well,
is it actually going to happen?
Well, it may be in the interests of both sides to string it out. Yeah.
But Trump is not going to stay, is he? You know, if he doesn't get what he wants, he's going to be off in a huff.
Well, no, but you can say, well, we've agreed on certain things, but we've not agreed on other things, and we'll agree to another meeting or something. Don't forget, the Israelis are twisting Trump's arm up his back to go to war with Iran. And I can't see that they'd want to go to war with Iran simultaneously as with North Korea. It's too... You never know, though, because in actual fact, there's an element of craziness in their policy. It's a bit like Hitler declaring war on the United States in 1941 when he didn't have to. And Kissinger, of course, we were talking about him earlier, he's always said that you've got to fight Russia or China and you've got to be nice to the other one in order to try and isolate. If you're going to be nice to the Chinese, you isolate the Russians, or you get nice with the Russians and isolate the Chinese. But fighting them both simultaneously is reckless and likely to fail.
I can almost see the ghost of Henry Kissinger in the corner, Martin, of the studio here.
Well, he's going to have his ghost. He's in Turin, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
The,
so,
the Godfather.
How does this fit in with what Kissinger will be up to today?
Well, the ruling class in the West is in disarray. Yeah, they can't work out what their strategy is. There isn't a strategy. And they have meetings like Bilderberg and other forums so they can try and thrash out their differences and then they can, you know, present a united front to the world. But increasingly that's becoming impossible, partly because of Trump, but partly because of just divergence of interests, fundamental divergence of interests.
I remember David Rockefeller when he was in Oxford doing a talk about Musk. God, must be 20 years ago. I went to see, actually, I think it was Noam Chomsky talking, and he quoted Rockefeller in Newsweek saying something needs to replace elected government and big business seems best place to do it.
Yeah, I mean, the elected governments have never been that powerful. The idea that we used to have sovereignty and we've lost it.
So did we not in the Second World War, for example?
No.
And did we not in 1945? When no.
There was a period from 1945 to 1973 when, because of the existence of the Soviet Union and Communist China, the Western elite were prepared to compromise with the lower orders in order to keep their power. But once communism collapsed and China became capitalist, they lost that taboo. And they've reverted to the type of society that we used to have before 1945, where essentially the wealthy run it with a formal consultation of the population, which doesn't mean anything much.
Things did change a lot in the 1970s, didn't they? And then at the end of it, we got Thatcherism.
Well, the 1970s, it was the 1973 oil price crisis, which was engineered by the Americans and the petrodollar
system.
Well,
hang on, it wasn't engineered. There was the October War. Yeah, but the Arab world attacked the Israelis and the Israelis.
The Israelis. The question of who started the 1973 war is quite interesting.
Is it?
Yeah. So let's not.
Let's go there.
Well, no, it's too complex. The point is that's the Israeli presentation of events. But don't forget that the outcome of this, whatever else we, you know, that's historical research. But the outcome was quite clear that the dollar, instead of being based ultimately on gold, as in the Bretton Woods system, became based on oil, and the oil was Saudi Arabian oil. The Saudi Arabians are the biggest producers.
Nixon took it off in 1971, didn't he?
Yes, that's right. But that period is when everything changed. So you had the gold, you know, the Bretton Woods system that was set up after World War II. various features in it. You know, some of them programmed by the British economist John Maynard Keynes, he was a very big negotiator at Bretton Woods. Which basically allowed governments in countries to pursue the interests of their own people and not to just subordinate them to outside capital flows.
Now, Bilderberg's taken place in Italy, and Italy has just been the subject of effectively a technocrat government being put in.
Well, it's not quite so. You said that last week. What's actually happened is the technocrats have been integrated into the populist government. So the populists of the Liga and, of course, the Five Star Movement have accepted a finance minister and a policy determined by the Troika.
But then, this is like chalk and cheese. Surely?
Well, no. It's very similar to what happened in Greece with Syriza.
Yeah.
They can't get rid of the government. They just make sure that they write the policy for them.
All right. Oil
and that's
and
what's going to happen.
Oil and water, not mixing.
No, it doesn't. Well, it mixed enough in Greece because what happened was the oil just got smashed and the water got everything it wanted, or vice versa. Syriza are now pursuing a policy which is completely determined by the Troika. And that's a brilliant way to run it, if you like. You've got a left-wing government which came to power determined to oppose the Troika's policies, and now they're imposing the Troika's policies. And therefore, there's no other forces. The right-wing doesn't oppose the Troika's policies, apart from the far right. They don't know anything about economics, so they've got what they want.
This is a form of rule by banksters.
Well, of course it is. It's capital rules our capitalist society, and democracy is literally a sham. And everybody says, oh, but democracy is a sham. It's like, yeah, have you know? Democracy has always been a sham. Haven't people noticed? And of course, the real problem here in Italy is because all this argy-bargy and arguing is actually weakening the Italian banks, who are the biggest bank. You know, they are the most in debt of all. And all of this rowing and arguing about Brexit, Italy, sanctions, blah, 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 it's going to crash the banking system. That's what's going to happen. And then we won't be talking like this at all. We'll be talking about something else. We won't be in Kansas anymore.
The IMF threatened Harold Wilson, didn't they, back in the 70s
yep.
too?
Yep, that's right. But don't forget, that was a more stable setup.
Yes, so we had virtually full employment.
But also it took a while for we're in a much more precarious situation today, where if they can't agree amongst themselves and sort out what they want to do, and they clearly can't, then the possibility of it all going down the drain is definitely there. Because we've got 8 years of money printing to unwind.
I just think it's quite often useful and handy, and I don't see much of this on the mainstream press, to take a step back from current events and see how, this is what, you know, while we're discussing the 70s now, why, you know, how we got where we are.
Well, that's right, because in actual fact, most of where you are now is going to be determined by your previous actions. And most people think history doesn't matter, but in actual fact, it over-determines everything. There's very little new under the sun. And everything is related to what went before.
Can you say something about the forces that were behind forcing Harold Wilson out in 1976?
Well, it was quite clear. I mean, there was a change of a policy from 1973 onwards. They'd taken the dollar off gold. A Labour government, even though it wasn't a particularly radical Labour government, was no longer the sort of thing they were going to accept.
Well, there were also smears, weren't there, saying that Harold Wilson was a Russian agent.
Well, that's how they worked it. James Jesus Angleton, who was the head of the CIA's counterintelligence operation, although ultimately he was exposed as being a freak and he was not under control. But he told MI5 that the Prime Minister was a Russian agent, and MI5 very patriotically said, "Oh, great! Well, let's get rid of him then." And of course, they went to work to get rid of him. It's all in Penrose and Courtier's book, and
the Pencourt files,
and also in the film the Wilson plot, which was on BBC Two a few years ago. It's quite clear that the British intelligence services interpreted their role as being to undermine the Labour government and the Labour Prime Minister as part of their patriotic duty to help America, to make us do what they wanted us to do.
Anyway, looking at the
and
slow
still like that now.
Stripping away of democracy over the last 30 or 40 years, let's go back now to 1975 to have listened to some press reports about Harold Wilson.
You know, the people in the City of London, they weren't liking it. And people who work as stockbrokers usually have come from the best schools, and a lot of them have titles, you know. They weren't liking it at all.
One of the main byproducts of the disinformation campaign in 1973-74 was the dramatic growth of paramilitary organisations in the United Kingdom.
We thought, therefore, that we must form some sort of organisation which would come in if the government fell.
Fearing Wilson was unable or unwilling to prevent anarchy, former military officers like General Walter Walker and Major Alexander Greenwood began to form private armies, thousands strong, to protect Queen and country.
The subject of the breakdown of law and order, when does it happen? I suppose some people say that it's already happened. Our own Prime Minister...
Many of these organizations were organized and run by very experienced, very patriotic people who genuinely believed that the system of law and order in the country was breaking down.
If you plot to destroy this present system, what are you doing? You are committing a form of treason. I have taken an oath of allegiance to my Queen, and I'm not prepared to see that oath interfered with.
I know the Queen. She wasn't very happy with Mr. Harold Wilson. There was not much she could do about it at that time. And Lord Mountbatten rang up General Sir Walter Walker one evening and said, "If you want any help from me, will you let me know?" General Sir Walter Walker had prepared a sort of speech which the Queen might read out on the BBC, asked the people to stand behind the armed forces as there was a breakdown of law and order and the government could not keep the unions in control.
What motivates us is purely patriotism. I've got awfully little faith in the present situation of Parliament as a whole, whether Conservative or Socialist.
Penrose and Courtier learned from the founder of the SAS, Colonel David Stirling, that the situation had become so serious that a military coup was again under consideration. Stirling planned to provoke the unions into a confrontation.
The leaders would suddenly start to go missing. He thought, let's attack the leaders, let's get them run over by a bus. Then they'll start thinking.
If a political strike is going to cause the country and the economy irreversible damage, we're there.
The idea of a preemptive strike against the possible assumption of power by someone else who wasn't elected. I mean, I would have regarded anything like that as a military coup, and should be regarded as such.
Well, bearing in mind that these people were motivated for the real reasons, one can only surmise that the bulk of the information that they were reacting to was the disinformation which we and other parts of the government apparatus was producing at that stage. One of the other side effects of psychological operations is that once we actually created false information about an individual or an organization, members of the intelligence community also believed it. Like the circle.
Brian Crozier, a former intelligence officer, was one of those who began openly to try to enlist the armed forces.
I took it upon myself to make them understand the problems of communism and the problem that at some time or other they might even have to intervene in favour of destroying the communist danger. There was a sudden kind of absolute silence. They wanted to hear every word that I said. This was a problem that agitated them. The military people, I can't name any, who had seriously considered the possibility of a military takeover. This was quite a widespread attitude. They wanted to know whether there might be a time when the military had to intervene to prevent communism being imposed. And this is true. I'm not making it up.
Finally, the troops took to the streets. The public was told it was a routine anti-terrorist exercise at Heathrow. In fact, it was a show of force in response to alleged communist infiltration at the airport. The battle for Britain seemed about to begin.
I mean, the first thing you do if you want to control a country is to take over the airports, take over the BBC, and protect Buckingham Palace with the Queen. If you've got those three things, you're pretty well in control, you know.
There was talk of coups, of some counter-revolution to throw Wilson and the Labour government out, and one heard that kind of chatter.
That was the voice of Colin Wallace, former MI5 officer over in Northern Ireland. Martin, interesting time.
I don't think he was MI5, but yes.
Interesting. So was he Army Intelligence?
That's Army Intelligence, yeah.
But, I mean, we're also faced with this question now. I mean, as they have been in Italy, when the head of state refuses to install a government that has just been elected, then you do wonder if the Queen in this country, or whether it's the President over in Italy, are actually taking a little bit more power than they should. They're not there to sort of guide the country as for the will of the people, but they're there to actually sometimes intervene. I mean, there was no real possibility that Harold Wilson was going to be bringing in a communist system. It was actually a fairly light-touch socialist system that he wanted, and that was what the people had voted for.
Indeed, but you've got to remember that the state, the Italian state, the British state, is originally a repressive institution created by the ruling class to keep the masses down. And they've been gradually democratised. And don't forget, Italy was not really a democracy. It was a fascist dictatorship until 1945. And then afterwards, the Communist Party were very strong in Italy, but they were never allowed to form a government. And NATO, through its Gladio networks, carried out terrorism in Italy, including the kidnapping of the Prime Minister.
Well, in the 1980s...
Aldo Moro was kidnapped in 1979. He was the Prime Minister of Italy. He's kidnapped and
murdered. In the 1980s, we had the P2 scandal.
Yes, but I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
And this was effectively a committee of police chiefs and newspaper owners and bankers and army chiefs that were running the country.
Yes, and Italy has basically got a fascist history. Britain hasn't got a fascist history, it's got an imperialist history. So people think that the Queen and the House of Lords and the army are the state, and who happens to be the Prime Minister through the luck of elections is a minor matter for those people. I mean, frankly, those attitudes haven't gone away. And of course Mountbatten, who phoned up General Sir Walter Walker to offer his support, possibly as a figurehead military dictator, well, he paid the price in the West of Ireland when the IRA murdered him, didn't he?
What about newspaper owner Cecil King? He was the head of IPC. He was another major player in these coup plotting in the 1975.
Well, I mean, this history is terribly important because it shows what the state in Britain is really like. And of course, what they were worried about was that, you know, the workers were rebelling. There'd been two miners' strikes.
I think I'm right in saying IPC at the time owned the Times.
Yeah.
And this is the owner of the Times.
Well, now, Rupert Murdoch owns the Times, and if you think his views are any more to the left than these people, you're wrong. We've actually got a revanchist right-wing attitude in this country and elsewhere in the world. It hasn't gone away. It's not as if it's something that happened in the 1970s and they gradually got better and more sensible and everybody grew up. And that's not the case at all. In actual fact, the stuff they were doing then was pretty amateurish compared to what they do now. Now we've got Brigade 77, which is a whole 1,000-strong brigade of the British Army, staffed entirely by officers who spend their whole day on the internet pretending to be people other than they are, in order to sway the public opinion in the direction they want it to go. There was nothing like that in the 1970s. Colin Wallace and people like him were beavering away, creating fake news and false information and disinformation, but it was relatively low-key compared to what goes on now. I mean, huge resources are now dedicated to brainwashing and bamboozling people.
More recently, we've had an army general, haven't we, saying that there would be a mutiny, warned that Jeremy Corbyn could face a mutiny from the military if he became Prime Minister.
Well, that's making that pretty clear, aren't they? I would suggest that if this was a democratic country, that guy should lose his job and his pension. The same thing was said by the former head of MI6. This is absolutely unacceptable.
Martin, the general added that a Labour victory under Mr Corbyn in 2020 would result in mass resignations at all levels, and there would be the very real prospect of an event which effectively would be a mutiny. While Labour publicly refused to comment on the views, what it described as an anonymous general in private, senior sources described their remarks as pretty outrageous. That was reported just in September 2015.
Yeah, well, on that point, I would point out that in Venezuela, when they tried to carry out a coup, or certain elements within the army tried to carry out a coup, they failed, and then they all resigned. Now, if what he's saying is all of these people who want a coup will resign from the army, then that will be good, because then we'll find the junior officers that are loyal, and they will be promoted. And, of course, they've got to realise that if you resign in that way, you lose your pension. We're not paying for you. You can walk out if you want, but you're not coming back and you're not getting your pension. And in actual fact, we want you to resign. We may actually sack you. If we can, I would say, if Labour comes to power and we can identify that general, we should sack him and take his pension, because that is not what public servants are supposed to do. It's as simple as that. He took a risk there by opening his mouth. Very serious risk.
But, I mean, if that sort of thing is going on in the officers' mess, surely it's better that we hear about it.
Well, it is indeed, but also I would suggest that to the officers in the officers' mess, if you were in the police force or in any other organisation and you started talking like that about the way the organisation is, runs and all the rest of it, then you could lose your job. It's a sackable offence, all of that. Their feet shouldn't touch the floor. The army's supposed to obey orders. That's what they're supposed to do. And if they don't obey orders, it ain't an army. And therefore, those who aren't prepared to obey orders have got to be cashiered, kicked out, lose their pensions. And that should shut them up. And in fact, if they think like that, we don't want them. We want them out.
Well, there are quite a few whistleblowers in the armed forces, and there have been over the years.
Well, Colin Wallace was armed forces, and he exposed all of this.
Yeah.
The lower level officers are not necessarily in on this stuff, and they're not necessarily happy about it. And they could, of course, carry out a counter coup against the senior officers.
One of the major problems is that we've got increasing privatisation. We heard last week, didn't we, Martin, about this brand new US aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford, that just won't go. Basically, there's billions been spent on this aircraft carrier, but it can't even chug along. What do you make of the slow privatisation of the things like Ministry of Defence, attempts anyway to privatise Ministry of Defence procurement, and vast amounts of money going to these companies like Raytheon, who are building drones, etc.?
Well, there are two aspects to it. The first aspect is that one of the problems with the Western military is it's basically a money spinner. It's a jobs for the boys operation. The Russians are just cutting military expenditure because they've got better things to spend their money on, because they've got all the weaponry they need to fight any fight that they need to fight, and they don't want to waste any more money on it. In the West, we love spending money on it, or rather the military love spending money on it, because they're getting a big fat salary out of it, and they get on the boards of the companies supplying the weaponry afterwards. And the other thing, of course, about privatisation, it means that the line of accountability is broken. So one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing, and therefore you can carry out all kinds of terrorist attacks, and that's what was happening in Italy in the 70s and the 80s. The terrorist attacks were being orchestrated against the elected government by NATO intelligence services, including
MI6.
Have
we ever had that sort of thing going on here in Britain?
Yes, of course we have. The bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, according to the Garda Síochána, were definitely carried out by the Glenane gang working with explosives supplied by MI5.
What about last year's terrorist attacks and possibly the 7/7 London
Well,
bombing?
The fact is, Tony, going back in history, the British Army have been involved, and British intelligence services have been involved in fomenting terrorism, including the creation of Al-Qaeda under Operation Cyclone, in which Britain was the lead agency.
Now, I'm talking about these specific attacks last year.
Well, I'm just saying, if you know the history, then the idea that these attacks could have been orchestrated from inside the structure is pretty obvious. Like, just one little, for example, the Westminster Bridge attack, we are expected to believe that there is no CCTV footage of the attack because of spending cuts. Westminster Council have apparently switched off all the CCTV around Westminster and around Parliament.
Oh, yeah.
Can you believe that?
And what happened to the driver of the...
Who was a
white guy who witnesses said ran off.
That's right, Tony. And of course, if you know the history of NATO intelligence services psychological warfare operation, I think you're probably the most likely thing about all those attacks is they're orchestrated from inside the structure. We're already at war with our own army and security services. But of course, people in Ireland know all about
it. Surely
this.
It's not the entire armed force.
No, it
isn't. What are you talking about?
Well, that's why they break it up into little groups. But in any case, we've got people, senior people, as you just said, who've came straight out and said it, that they will carry out some kind of coup against the Corbyn government. Now, even if you were going to carry out a coup, you should keep your mouth shut. And it just shows how incompetent, and basically, they shouldn't be there. And if it comes to the crunch, then we'll have to see what happens, won't we? Because it's not actually that easy to take over a whole society and succeed.
We were talking about privatisation briefly there, but one of the aspects of privatisation of the military is GCHQ. We don't often hear about that. We've heard that there are all sorts of aspects of the signals intelligence, which is supposed to be non-political, which is being privatised, and also quite a lot of politicisation of these big institutions. Now, back in the 1980s, I remember the Thatcher government making sure that there were no trade unions at GCHQ allowed.
That's right.
So they saw trade unions as some kind of security threat.
They did.
I mean, surely that's legitimate.
Not really. There'd been trade unions in GCHQ for years because they're civil servants. They're not military. They're civil servants, and they're entitled to join unions. And of course, the police have the Police Federation and so on. This legitimate for people to have professional associations and so on and so forth.
Now,
but the point is that, you know, they've pulled everything in their own direction.
Now, our sister show Dialect, which goes out at midday on Tuesdays here on BCFM, this week we're doing an in-depth interview with a chap called Alex Thompson. He used to be a GCHQ officer up at Cheltenham, and he appears regularly every Wednesday, I think it is, on another programme called the UK Column, run by a former naval commander called Brian Gerrish down in Plymouth. And so you can catch Alex Thompson most Wednesdays on there. But I thought it'd be interesting to have a chat to him about what he thought of his eyewitness account, really, of the sorts of privatisation and other things that have been going on at GCHQ while he was there, and just generally his views on the whole surveillance industry.
There are increasing partnerships, as they are often called, between GCHQ and private companies. This process is very dismaying. And through the Cold War, GCHQ did everything in-house, developing its own software and kit. But through the 90s, particularly, I think, after the departure of the last really good and patriotic and unquestionable director of GCHQ, who was Sir David Omand, O-M-A-N-D, since that time, there has been increasing evidence of third way or third sectorism creeping in and public-private partnerships. Under the name of PFI, Private Finance Initiative, GCHQ was actually the largest of these flagship Blair policy items of a public-private partnership, because the donut itself, the building, was built and is still occupied and operated, by a consortium of private operators, including notoriously Carillion, who've just gone bankrupt. But Group 4, also a local company, the boss used to live up the road from Cheltenham at Winchcombe, was heavily involved because Group 4, under a consortium named GSL, run most of the building services, the security, the staff facilities, the computing. And there's various other people involved in that. But that's really something that the staff above all see. In terms of the actual work of GCHQ, it is, strictly speaking, contrary to the whole slew of acts of parliament that have gone been enacted along the years, for anyone other than GCHQ as an arm of Her Majesty's government to be doing signals intelligence, electronic intelligence this is these days mostly. But in practice, it does seem that contractors are getting a foot in the door. You also see the same carousel, the revolving door that you see in other branches of government, where people develop a skill on Her Majesty's tax-paid money and then go private and get hired to do the same job for more money, and then come back in the door, as it were. So it is a very worrying process, and also the techniques of signals intelligence pioneered at GCHQ, because that's where the mathematical and technical and linguistic brains are and the software skills. These are being spun out, as we have seen local councils and police forces become increasingly Orwellian for years. A famous case being East Lothian, a Scottish local authority which openly advertised for its staff to be able to spy on Facebook posts. This strays into legally regulated territory, but the councils feel under Regulation of Investory Powers Act and its amendments and successions that they're able to do that. So by hook and by crook, what used to be unquestionably GCHQ as central government's competences have been spun out to private contractors and third-rate, shall we say, pseudo-spooks in local government.
There is a real serious problem with private contractors working in this area, and that is that they're not necessarily devoted to one master. Because of the basics of private, the way private businesses work, if someone comes along and offers them a contract, then they may well take that And Carillion were involved in the Abbey Wood Ministry of Defence procurement contract as well. So this whole concept of having potentially criminal companies and individuals involved with military contracting, has there been any attempt to do anything about that, to your knowledge, Alex?
It was actively suppressed that we should talk about this during my decade, the noughties, at GCHQ. It was, obviously, you've got several thousand highly intelligent and cynical people from different professional walks of life in the same building and on the same staff networks, even if they're at different physical locations. So you can imagine the staff news groups and staff forums online were, in a secure classified system, this is, were buzzing with this kind of talk. But it was actively dissuaded. We were told regularly from the kind of HR world at GCHQ, you mustn't question the patriotism of people who've come in sideways. You mustn't question the commitment of contractors vis-a-vis regularly hired staff who've gone through the Her Majesty's Government recruitment and loyalty process, as it were. And increasingly, we get foreign intrigue coming into this as well. Huawei, well known, of course, for its dinky mobile phones now, but it wasn't a decade ago. It's still majority owned by the People's Liberation Army, the communist Chinese totalitarian military government. And they supplied the new version of our secure internal telephony sometime around 2007, if I remember correctly. And this caused a great to-do. But, of course, the side of GCHQ that advises on technical security, which in those days was called CESG, the Communications Electronic Security Group, but has now spun off to London and has the Gucci new name of the Cyber Security Centre, NCSC. That arm of GCHQ cracked down on our questions, saying BT and the government have examined this and found that there's nothing to worry about. So there was a repetitive theme through the 2000s of staff who were mostly not that political, or certainly not awake in terms of seeing the full gamut of corporate involvement and banking involvement in government. But many of them were asking what's going on here, because you would have to be blind to miss these signs during the Blair and Brown era. But they were told not to raise this. And of course, most British civil servants put their head down and keep doing as they're told to pay the mortgage off. In fact, I had some colleagues who actually said to me, I have to pay the mortgage, otherwise I wouldn't be carrying on doing this job and biting my lip.
You mentioned banking and government there. That's not necessarily two organisations that sit well together, banking being all about making profit and secrecy, whereas government is supposed to be looking after its population, including some of the most vulnerable in society.
This is very true. It was when I was a child and watching BBC News growing up that I realised that the encroachment of banking into government, Tony Benn, not of my political persuasion, but a very honest, patriotic and farsighted man, was talking about this in the 80s, how the stock market was being held up in the news and by the government as almost the perfect mirror of society and the way that society should be going, which it had never been before. The city kind of encroaching increasingly into public life and putting its men in key positions and making its paradigms the ones that public service should also follow. There's been a lot of that. You saw it in GCHQ in terms of banking style performance related pay, which is a bit of a nonsense for public service. It's a different ethos completely. So we have seen a lot of this going on through the years, yes.
And what about 2013? Because this is when we saw the emergence, funnily enough, during the four-day Bilderberg conference at Watford, the emergence of a character called Edward Snowden, and him being a whistleblower from the National Security Agency in the US, he revealed various things which I suppose we'd now look back and say, you know, before that, people who talked about this kind of thing were labelled as conspiracy nuts.
This is true. I don't really have any detailed comment on Snowden's papers because I don't want to cross the line of talking about things that are covered by the Official Secrets Act. I have this kind of odd reservation about doing so, although I know that it's all out there in the public domain. All I'll say is he did so after careful consideration. There's a long tradition now of whistleblowers, particularly in the signals intelligence agencies, both NSA and GCHQ, going public after getting nowhere internally, partly because of the things we've just been discussing, Tony, the increasing corporatism and bankingness of government and the intelligence agencies, the encroachment of contractors, the blurred lines and the culture of not even speaking internally about these things, not airing these issues.
I mean, surely at GCHQ, I mean, it's normal. Secrecy is normal. You're working for the Secret Services.
Secrecy towards the outside world, yes, but the whole time I was at GCHQ, with the building of this open plan donut in particular, I now have other views about that building. I think it symbolises an encroachment of banking ideas and the all-seeing eye and the like, but we were being told that we needed to be more like a management consultancy and have knowledge sharing and a buzz around our work and sharing maximally within classification permissions, so that only in certain need-to-know areas was there firewalls. So that was the theory of it. The practice is, if you raised even basic questions about who is loyal to what and whether we're doing things as well as we used to or as well as we should, you were told, well, we don't want to be taking the discussion that way. An inner core of politicised people was clearly taking over, as in the rest of the civil service, and my colleague Brian Gerrish has explained the main, as better than anyone else has explained the main mechanism through which this has happened in the civil service, which is the political charity Common Purpose. They are really the new sacerdotal caste in the public sector, and they tell us really where we have to shut up and where we are allowed to speak. So that's where the secrecy is coming in. It's very good of you to mention, Tony, that banking and secrecy go together almost more than government and secrecy do, because indeed I had some of my old Cambridge university friends going into the City of London when I went into intelligence, and the procedures they described to me for securing documents and having a need-to-know basis of discussion at work were actually even stricter, a lot more strict in city banks than they ever have been in intelligence agencies. Perhaps I would venture to say because more money is at stake there. GCHQ had been housed in a post-war series of buildings which had closed spurs to them, so you had a separate lock for each office wing of 100 people or so, and in some areas even tighter than that. You had individual offices by default in some areas, which is also practical, because if you're doing transcribing linguistic material or doing mathematical deep work, then you do need a room of your own. But we were moved into this building in 2004, which has become known as the Donut, this large, round, torus-shaped building on the edge of Cheltenham, because we were told that the facilities were out of date, which I suppose they were, and because we needed a larger premises post-9/11, which is about the time that the decision was taken to move us. But there was great dissatisfaction with the new building. The manning of all the facilities by a consortium that charged full whack and overpriced some of the services was one aspect of that. The deliberate failure to build enough car parking spaces as another. That was because of Gloucestershire County Council telling the GCHQ that we needed to be a flagship success of the Blair government's green policy schemes. All these things added up to frustrate the staff immensely, really. You could say that it's civil servants whinging, but the facilities were almost deliberately under-engineered for us. And the director who announced the move to the Donut, but who signally did not actually hang on to see us into the Donut, he went off to be the governor of Gibraltar instead, left a sour taste in our mouth, because as well as being very heavy-handed and arrogant and refusing to accept that staff were disgruntled by these small but important practical matters, he actually said in a staff circular once that it is our problem, not yours, to ensure that you can get to work and that you have a space for your park, to park your car and to sit at and work when you get to work. And that, of course, failed. There was no success in that regard. So that there were elementary failures, really, to provide for the staff.
Well, that's very interesting insider's view, isn't it, about what's been happening. I didn't realise that the Donut was as recent as that. I thought it'd been there longer than that. And of course,
secret. How long it's been there. But no, I mean, what he's saying shocking, really, isn't it, to hear that a secure telephony system is actually Chinese-made, Chinese-built.
Well, that's one of the problems if you, contract stuff out. Well, that's right. I mean, if you're going to have contracting out and best value and all the rest of it, then that really cuts against any kind of military principles of secrecy and security.
And what about this idea that the staff there are told, well, you mustn't bring these things up?
Well, that's because, you know, basically, they're probably a bit naive to presume that they're there to do some kind of, you know, independent job and that all they've got to do is be professional about it. The state has got its interests, and the interests of the state are determined by the powerful people who control the state. And I don't think there ever was a golden age when British secret services were apolitical. We know, going back to the creation of MI5, MI6 and so on, that they were always conceived of as essentially right-wing political projects to keep the population in line and the wars running. Nothing changes.
Getting back to the future of humanity being decided this weekend, not necessarily in Singapore and not necessarily in Quebec or wherever the G7 is taking place, but actually in Turin. What is this faction, this private interest faction? It just seems to me that even the basic aspects of government, like something like GCHQ, which is so incredibly important in making a country secure, at least attempting to, spying on terrorists, this sort of thing, that the private industry is right inside there as well.
Well, there's obviously a mainstream point that privatisation is a very bad idea when you've got sort of military security at stake. But you've also got to recognise that what privatisation does is it creates the possibility for rogue elements, if we can call them that, to use their knowledge and information to try and manipulate the population through things like false flag terrorism. As I said earlier, Harold Wilson was bumped out of power by these forces. The Prime Minister of Israel, Aldo Moro, was kidnapped and assassinated. That was all in the late 1970s. And, of course, we've been going downhill since then. The intelligence services and their private sector buddies have basically taken over. And they're far more powerful than most people realise.
OK, some of the bigger things going on in the world. This Korean War, the signature of the end, official end of the 1950s Korean War may be signed next Tuesday.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, there's some hope here, because it makes sense for everybody to calm down and just negotiate. There's no a nuclear war or even a conventional war in Korea is going to be disastrous for humanity. It won't just be contained. It's going to create all kinds of problems. Also, it's not in anybody's interest.
Also in Afghanistan, the Prime Minister has announced a ceasefire for Ramadan. Okay. Yeah, no fighting with the Taliban.
Yeah, but the Taliban won't necessarily go with that, will they? So that doesn't necessarily
mean much.
Well,
they've both agreed.
If they've both agreed it, well, that's possibly a positive as well, because everybody agrees that the Taliban will have to be included in any peace agreement in Afghanistan. So if that's happening, then that's possibly a good development.
Also, there is some sort of recount, apparently, in Iraq, people not trusting the elections.
Yeah, well, there's bound to be rows. It's quite tricky to run elections in a country where bombs are going off and people are being assassinated all day, every day. Most people in Britain have forgotten about the Iraq war, that terrible stuff that happened a few years ago. But, of course, the people in Iraq haven't forgotten about it. It never ends.
Also, the US military is saying that Gitmo probably won't close for decades. That's Guantanamo Bay that Obama was supposed to shut.
Yeah, well, they're also running lots of other secret prisons all over the world, which have no basis in legal basis whatsoever. I mean, back in the day when Syria was our ally, they were torturing people on behalf of MI6 and the CIA.
Finally, the local story: the city council wants 15-mile-an-hour speed limits now, not 20.
Well, I was a bit fed up with the 20-mile-an-hour speed limit, but I don't think, in actual fact, you don't need to drive fast in most roads in Bristol.
And
it's
also,
not necessary.
You've only got Saturday and Sunday if you want to use the Metro bus for free. Otherwise, you need to download their Nightmare app. Anyway, we'll be back after the news. That is the Murdoch News at 7 now. Join us after the news as we go to Turin in Italy to Bilderberg.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.